the briefing from the CIADB. The one of the entities that falls under the department. We also want to express right at the beginning the appreciation of the presence of the Deputy Minister. Particularly given the fact that we are, I think we are closing, we are almost beginning to close the first 12 months of the fixed administration. Also, I think what is critical is to reiterate the fact that the first engagement that we're having with the Construction Industry Development Board. So it will also serve probably as a reintroduction in terms of how the entity operates. But I think it is important to also put to the fore the fact that by legal we are permanent delegates from provinces as a national council of province. So effectively we are not a copycat of the portfolio committee, the other side of the house. So therefore our appreciation will be also more focused in terms of your provincial footprints and focus, so that at least as we go back to our provinces, at least we are able to be focused in terms of the work that we are doing, so that in our exercise and quest to hold the entity accountable, we are not all over the show, but rather in terms of the provincial focus. But be that as it may, let me introduce myself and the team. They will introduce themselves and then we'll then give over to the minister, deputy minister, to introduce the team. My name is Kenny Mui Mao, a permanent delegate from the Northern Cape Province.
Thank you very much, Chair. Morning to everyone. My name is Brenda Matebula. I'm from Limpopo Province.
Good morning to everyone. Sonia Bosoff and Mpumalanga.
Morning. My name is Shapilon from the Western Cape.
Morning. Thank you, Honourable Chairperson. My name is Lydia Mshodi from the Free State Province. Thank you.
Good morning, everyone. My name is Tim Ngosi-Naplini from Eastern Cape.
Morning, Dirk Winterbach from PMG.
Can we then give over to the...
Good morning, everyone. My name is Phupheka Mtilini. I'm the committee secretary.
Good morning, everyone. My name is Tepo Makanye. I am the committee researcher.
Good morning, everyone. I'm Enrico Bezira, and I'm the committee assistant.
Deputy Minister.
Thank you, Chair. Good morning to the honourable members and the team. Not all of it is my name, Deputy Minister, Department of Public Works and Infrastructure. Well, I'm with the team. I'm not sure whether I should just allow them to introduce themselves. But it's the CIDB leadership, the chairperson, together with the senior management. But probably let me allow them to introduce themselves.
That will be appreciated, Deputy Minister.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you very much, DM. Good morning, Honourable Chairperson and Honourable Members. My name is Nonkululeko Sindane. I'm the chairperson of the CIDP. Thank you.
Good morning. My name is Cyril Kamete. I'm the chief executive of CIDP.
Good morning. My name is Ibrahim Mullah. I'm the director of construction industry regulation.
Good morning. My name is Susan Tibanda. I'm the CFO of the CIDP.
Good morning, Chairperson and Honorable Members. My name is Mpo Mashaba, and I'm the Director in the Public Entities Unit in the Department of Public Works.
Good morning, everyone. My name is Vuyile Mkhebe, PLO in the Office of the Deputy Minister. Thank you.
Three Honorable Members who have just arrived, let us give them an opportunity also to introduce themselves as they settle.
Good morning, Chair Mohammed Dango, Gauteng, member of this committee.
Good morning, Chair Yavi Klansman, Northwest.
Honourable Rotterdam, can you introduce yourself?
Good morning, everyone. Sorry I'm late. Chair Tim Bradisett, KZD, member of the committee. Thank you.
Honourable Dango.
Your person, I see we go on to 1 o'clock. Can we go to about 12:45? We have another whoops meeting at 1 o'clock.
Thank you, Honourable Dango, for sensitizing us on that. Honourable Langsman.
Yes, Chair. Myself, I will have to leave on 12. We have strategy meeting at 12. The whoops is 1 o'clock, but strategy is 12.
Thank you, Honourable Members. We have also received an apology from Honourable Minister for Richard Delay. Honourable Khai, he will be late because of the domestic issues. He will be back because he had to start at the pharmacy to get medication for a daughter. Thank you, Honourable. We'll then give over to the Deputy Minister for Open Remarks.
Thank you, Honourable Chairperson and Honourable Members. Mine is short. At least you've already dealt with the first part, that the apology from the Minister, as it is Wednesday. She's attending Cabinet. And also because of the fact that the entities, as we share responsibilities, and all entities are my responsibility. So we appreciate the noting of that apology. The CIDP, as you will note in the presentation, is a body which should assist government and the people of South Africa in regulating the industry, construction industry, with a view to ensure that that industry lives up to the expectation of citizens with respect to transformation of the industry, with respect to making a meaningful contribution and impact on the lives and of the people and the economy of our country. And therefore, I hear Chairperson as correctly mandated to account as the CIDP to this structure. I was happy when you're saying you're not a copycat, because that was my first explanation this morning, that no, in South Africa we have two houses, and one house represents all our provinces. And therefore, I will not waste the committee's time with a long introduction. I think we know who's here now. Mine is to allow both the chair and the CEO to take us through the presentation, and so that we give the honourable members enough time to ask questions, to engage with the report. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Deputy Minister. The floor is given to the Chair.
Thank you very much, Honourable Chair. In speaking to the annual report, there are a few things that we would just like to highlight to the committee, especially because we are being invited to the committee at least for the first time since I have been the chair. So for us, we want to appreciate that and hope that we will learn a lot from the questions that are going to be put to us, and that we will be able to respond as honestly as we can, and where we are not able to, that we will be able to be given an opportunity to supplement in written form. So we thank you for that. The context of the annual report is that we had not had a full executive team for a very long time. So when we were performing in the year under review, there were certain things that we had to put in place to ensure that at least minimum performance happens as we had promised, and of course we also perform according to the targets that we had given ourselves. So you will see in the overall delivery of the presentation that a great degree of targets were met, but there were targets that were not met, and I just want to put that up front. There were also certain big interventions that the CIDB did, and those interventions are currently underway, and you will hear a lot on them, and I just thought I'll highlight a few of those. One, you will hear us talking about OD. OD is organizational development. And organizational design. It's a process where we were reconfirming the capacity in the organization, looking at vacancies and capacity that is needed, looking at an appropriate structure, and those kinds of issues. So when you hear about that, that will be what we mean. Secondly, we will talk a lot about the office accommodation and the plans around that. We've made significant progress since then, but when we talk about it, it will mean that right now we are on a month-on-month lease basis at head office, and generally also in the regions where we had previously been accommodated by Public Works at no cost to us. But now we need to move away from that and procure our own regional accommodation as well. So we will also talk about technology, and I would imagine from your various constituencies, you perhaps contractors would have raised issues around that. We are working on a new technology system, which we believe will improve the playing by the sector. However, as with all good things, you first go through some teething problems, and that's where we are at this point in time. And then finally, we will be speaking about executive appointments, and perhaps at this point, Chair, I may indicate that the two people that are with us from executive management, Mr. Cyril Gamete, has recently been appointed, started on or about the 17th of January 2020 with the CIDB after almost 5 years of not having a CEO. And then the CFO started not so long ago. I think he is almost a year, almost a year in the position. So we are grateful for that. And then finally, overall, we are comfortable. We are not happy, but we are comfortable with our performance. We realize that there are many issues which are of a transformational nature that we need to put a particular priority to, and transformation not just on the basis of race, but transformation on the basis of a transformed service that we offer to our clients, a transformed experience that our clients experience from us, but most importantly, technically, that the work is done and it yields value for the client at whatever level of government. At this point, for a technical presentation, I would hand over to Mr. Gamete to take the committee through the presentation. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much, Honorable Member. The layout of the presentation is that I'll just start with the overview so that we can understand, you know, what CIDB is all about. And then I will also go to the annual report highlights, where I'll speak about the achievements and other highlights, and also talk about those things which we did not achieve, and also plans on how to achieve them in future. And then we'll also talk about the audit outcomes, as well as the action plan. And then we'll also then speak to the financials of the report. Right, on the overview, we do have a legislative mandate because there is a CIDB Act. In that Act, there are objects of the Act which we have summarized. The first one is to provide strategic leadership, you know, to the construction sector and make sure that it is also sustainable growth in the sector. And mainly also that in the sector, the emerging contractors take part in the sector because there is still a lot of imbalance. The other one is to make sure that there is improved performance and best practice. If you look at some of the construction projects, there have been lots of complaints about how contractors, you know, do the work, you know, the work is not finished, it's not of the same quality. So we are there to make sure that with the regulation, we can make sure that there is good performance there. Uniform application of policy and ethical standards, procurement, construction reform, and delivery. So we want to make sure that the construction sector, there is really uniform standards, because if the standards are different, and therefore the outcomes will be different as well. And now really one of the primary purpose of being there is monitoring and regulation performance of the industry, which includes registration of projects as well as contractors. That's not necessary to be a regulator. Sometimes you don't get a lot of accolades because many people don't necessarily enjoy regulation. So in summary, if we look at the legislative mandate, is that one, we are a regulator to regulate the industry. Secondly, is to develop and transform the industry. So I think those are the two things which characterizes CIDB. Now, in terms of our vision and mission, is that one, we want a transformed construction industry which is inclusive, making sure that people who were not meaningfully participating in this sector, they start participating and contributing. And the other one as well is that it must be ethical, you know, because we have had a few incidences where there was a lot of ethical issues in that area. So that is our vision. You know, a transformed construction industry which is inclusive and ethical. Now, in terms of our mission, it really tell the world why we exist. The main issue is that we regulate and develop the construction industry. But we can't do that alone, and therefore we always need partnerships with the stakeholders we are working with. Now, if we unpack our strategic outcomes, we have five strategic outcomes or strategic goals. One is inclusive growing the construction industry, making sure that those people who are not there before, they participate meaningfully. Innovative and thriving constructing environment. I mean, with the challenges of costs and technology, we need to be innovative, otherwise we cannot be competitive as South Africans. The third one is working in alliance or in partnerships. You know, it's important that we understand the industry, we take care of the things which are raised by our stakeholders. A reputable regulator, you know, people must
look at us as people who understand how to regulate, and we make sure that as part of regulation, we take care of the needs of all our stakeholders. Now, all of those things cannot really happen without sound corporate governance. So we actually value and make sure that we implement sound corporate governance. Now, there are programs which are helping us to achieve our vision as well as our mission. Program one is administration, which ensures that we can achieve sound corporate governance. And the core programs, 2 to 4, are reputable regulator, which is what we aspire to be. We want to be innovative, and there is a program which is called development and capacitation. And lastly, there is industry performance and transformation, which ensures that there is inclusivity in the growth of the industry. Now, in terms of our performance, we have a dashboard there which would show how the programs performed on the previous financial year. The overall achievement is 77%. Looking at it in its own, it might not be such a significant performance, but if you look at it compared to the previous year, where it was 30%, then it's actually quite a significant improvement from the previous year. Now I look at the highlights in each program, starting with administration. The first objective, strategic objective, was to increase revenue, alternative revenue, to actually complement with what we get from the department. The target was just shy of 92 million, and we were able to achieve just over 116 million. So that was achieved. The other target is to actually make sure that our ICT works properly, and we're looking at making sure that there is less than 15% of downtime in multiple systems, and we also achieved that target. The last target on administration is to comply with legislative requirements, and the important target there is 100% of service provider does paid within 30 days, because it's very important, especially for emerging contractors, and we also achieved that target. Okay, no, there's some more on administration. The other one is our performance internally, where we say our employees must perform at least above 3.3%, and the average was just under 3.4%. And the other one, the other important part is to interact with our stakeholders, who are very vibrant. We have an index which we used, where we are rated by our stakeholders. That index target was 25%, and we're able to achieve 55%. Now, in terms of other deliverables, in terms of stakeholder perception, how we did it was that we actually conducted a survey where various stakeholders were interviewed, and that is actually how we actually got to the index. We also what is called the National Stakeholder Forum, where we actually meet stakeholders nationally, and the legislative requirement is that the minister must also be in that meeting at least once a year, and therefore we did meet that target. On the next program, regulation and advocacy, the strategic objective here was to achieve 90% correlation of contracts awarded to the right level, and the target there was 96 of between grade 2 and 9, and we're able to meet the target at 99%. The other one is to also make sure that things to enhance provincial footprint is to make sure that not everything happens at head office, but we are there in the provinces to make sure that, you know, the contractors can be serviced in their respective provinces. And there is also an index where we are actually rated by those contractors at the province, and the target was 85% of grades 2 to 9, and our achievement was 96%, where applications were captured by provincial offices within 7 days. So it's very important that when contractors do applications, those are attended to timelessly. Now, the other deliverables which are important as well, it was the revision of tender values, because smaller contractors were complaining that the amount, the tender value limits really does not give them much opportunities because the values were very low. So we have adjusted that, and this adjustment took effect on the 7th of October 2019. The table here really indicates to us what was happening. If you look at the second column, where you've got current upper limit of tender value range, the current one, and then the third column is actually the new one. So grade one could only do 200,000 worth of work, but now they are able to do 500,000. Grade 2, 650,000, and now they can do 1 million. So that's what the industry appreciated very much, that they are getting now, they are able to tender for more value. Now the next program, development and capacitation, the strategic project there, objective there, was to improve the availability of developmental support. We also have an index in this section where 75% provincial business advisory services to contractors at grade 2 to 6 are provided, and that index we achieved it at 76%. We are also looking at people who are creating skills for this industry, so we are putting TVET colleges as part of our stakeholders, and we believe that they add in the development. So what we do with TVET colleges is that we expose them in the well skills for the construction trade, you know. So they do participate, and we had 20 TVET colleges as a target, but 22 colleges participated in those skills competitions. The other target here is the export advisory service, where we actually help our contractors to not only trade in South Africa but with other countries, but we encourage them that they start with the neighboring countries, and we're able to also achieve that target. Now, this business advisory services is that during the year under review, we provided advisory services to 100 contractors, which were selected from almost 400 contractors in various provinces. We also did a skills audit in these contractors to see what sort of gaps are there, which prevents them to be fully fledged contractors and also going to the next level. And this audit showed us those gaps, and then it helped us to develop a mentorship program where we can actually plug those gaps. And we've provided that mentorship services to 25 contractors in order to improve their competencies. The well skills, which are the competitions which I've talked about, is that the TVET colleges compete locally, and then basically the winners are then taken to the international skills competition. You know, different countries host this competition in the world, and from South Africa there were three students who actually participated in these world competitions. The export promotion, which I was talking about, CITP took 7 contractors to our neighboring countries, Swatini and Mozambique. And in Mozambique, there is quite a lot of potential of projects which will be happening shortly, and we will be supporting our contractors when they start engaging in our neighboring countries. In Mozambique, there is quite a lot of growth from roads to construction of transport, water, and sanitation projects. So we'll be helping them in that regard. The last one, which is industry and transformation. The strategic objective there was to monitor growth and transformation in the construction industry. Now, to actually monitor that, we need to actually have an objective view of looking at the statistics and how the trends in this industry. So the target there was to actually provide a report which will actually give us details in that regard. So the report was indeed produced, and I will show you briefly what actually came out of that report, which will help us to improve the transformation in that area. We also have to also spend some money in making sure that we develop and support some of the contractors. We had only 1 million at the moment, at the previous financial year, to support those contractors, but we spent about 1.5 million to support them. Now, the report, which helps us in transformation, you know, it helps us to give us an understanding of numbers and how things are transforming. Just in case of racial transformation, if we look at the transformation at various levels or grades, we can see that the higher you go, the less participation of black-owned companies. And therefore, our effort should be that we improve a lot in grade 7 to 8 going to 9. So we need to actually help those contractors in that level for further development. Also, in terms of gender transformation, the industry is performing quite poorly in this regard, as you can see the figures there. I think the worrying part is that the trends are not in the right direction. In fact, there is less participation in women-owned contractors, and therefore we need to actually put some ways of improving that. Now, that's why then there is a bit of focus in women in construction, and what we've done is to actually engage with women in construction. One activity was just a breakfast where we can understand some of the basic challenges they are having, and also that they network and have access to potential clients as well as fellow contractors who are actually doing well in the industry. We've just restructured the recognition of women, because there was some form of recognition of women in construction. We've just revamped that into a new program which we call EWIC, which is Empowerment and Recognition of Women in Construction. We are just hoping that the awards will be part and parcel of helping in the transformation process. Now, whilst we have achieved some of the things, there are areas where we did not perform well, and I will go through those. And in administration, there was an annual target where we had to do competency assessment, and there was an index which we were supposed to meet. And in fact, we got 0 in that index. Now, it might sound as if nothing has happened in that index, but I think it's important to give the context of that performance. Now, what we are doing, the chairperson indicated that there is organizational development, organizational design of the organization. Now, what we have done is that as the first part of organizational design was that we created a new structure, and then in that new structure, we made sure that all the people who are already employed at CIDP will fill up those positions, depending on their qualifications and their experience. So in other words, there are no interviews, but you look at the qualification, you look at the experience, and then you place the people. But what we're then supposed to do, what we're supposed to do after placing all of them, is that we then do competency assessments to look at the gap of the job as well as the competency of the person who's occupying it. Now, the challenges we have had is that it has taken a little bit longer to actually place people in those vacancies. We are still going to be doing competency assessments, but our new target date is the end of March to complete that. Now, the other one which we didn't meet is employee satisfaction, and the target was 54%. The target was 55%, and we got 54%. Now, the organization is undergoing a lot of change, and also there has been leadership vacuum for quite a couple of years, as the chairperson has indicated, and therefore it has to be expected that there is a lot of anxiety at the moment when people are still being placed. You know, that is actually why we haven't met that target. But we are hopeful that once everybody is placed and all other positions have been filled in, the employee satisfaction rating will improve. The other one is a strong audit risk rating on the final report. Usually, when the auditors rate you, they rate you on a scale of 1 to 5, where 4 and 5 is strong. So that's what we were hoping to achieve. But if you look at the average which we are achieving, it was a 3, which is moderate but not strong. There were a few issues which were highlighted, and we are actually having plans to make sure that those deficiencies which were highlighted will be closed. Now the next one on regulation and advocacy is 85% register of project information to be verified, and we also did not meet that one. Now the challenge there is that the target was ill-defined. It's not that the work, quite a lot of work was done, but unfortunately it did not match really the target in terms of how it was defined. So what we're doing there is to make sure that we are redefining the targets properly. And then the next one is the registration of contractors. To make sure that contractors are registered within the 21 days, which is a legislated imperative. The target is 100% and we got 99%. Now, one of the challenges which we have had in certain provinces is that you'd find in certain areas that there is disruption in terms of our communication. So we end up resorting to manual interventions. And unfortunately, manual interventions take longer because when you verify certain things, you know, it just takes a little bit longer and you have to recapture certain things. So it did slow us down in some of the provinces which contributed in our performance. Now, the next one is industry and transformation, and in here we're looking at 25 projects with contractor and professional services rating. Now, to just explain what we mean by this target here is that we wanted all the clients who have finished their projects to rate the contractors who are working for them, you know, so that we can see that all the interventions we are doing are becoming meaningful. Now, I think the challenge we had there is that it was a voluntary interaction with our clients. So we asked the clients to verify them, we give them the form, and after they've verified, well, after they've rated the contractors, they should return the forms to us. But because it's voluntary, unfortunately, there were few returns which came back to us. Now, we are going to be making some ways and means of making it a bit more mandatory to return these forms, or maybe work with the clients to actually see how we can improve in this area. So it was an external target which we have not met, but we will try to meet it after revising how we will deal with it. And then the other one on industry transformation is access to credit. It is also an external one because most contractors complain that they do get jobs from municipalities or parastatals, but they don't have enough money to actually put those projects into fruition. So as CITP, although we are not bankers, we were hoping to actually help them in getting access to money and credit. Unfortunately, we did not achieve that credit. But I think the way it was framed, I think that is the problematic part, because we're looking at an index. Probably the way we would be framing it in future is that we need probably to create memorandum of understandings with institutions who provide credit, and what we will do as CITP is to facilitate that relationship between contractors as well as the facilities for credit. Right, and the last part is audit outcomes and corrective action, and I will give that to the CFO who can do better than me in terms of money matters.
Thank you, CEO, members, the Deputy Chairperson, Chairperson of the CITP Board, and colleagues. In terms of the audit outcome, I think for the past 4 years, the CITP, we were able to achieve unqualified opinion, of course, with a bit of findings in other areas. The main challenge that have been actually hindering the CITP from obtaining the clean report is primarily on the annual performance report and the quality of the annual financial statement submitted for auditing. I think that the CEO did indicate that certain of our target were not clearly defined, and of course that will speak on the issue of reliability when we submit our information to the AG. I think if you're looking at the areas of focus which you're going to be focusing on, in terms of the upcoming audit which is starting end of May, we will focus on the usefulness and reliability of the information. We also need to improve on the record management. The critical vacancies need to be filled, and of course there's sort of an improvement in that particular one where the CFO and the CEO as well as the chief information officer have been filled, but of course we still have a bit of a one or two senior positions which still need to be filled, but we are making progress in that aspect. We also need to improve on the implementation of policies and procedures. Also need to improve on the control measures to detect non-compliance related to financial statement and performance reporting. So those are the issues which we are working on as we prepare for the next audit. We have developed an action plan which we are working on. which we do believe will actually assist us in terms of achieving or improving our opinion. In terms of the action plan, one is to align internal audit plan with the AG focus areas to identify area prior to the AG audit. By that, what we mean? We mean to say, of course, we do have internal audit capacity. We want to use it in a more effective manner whereby we use it as an early detection in terms of making sure that whatever that the internal auditors are able to pick also align to the AG methodology. And I think we're working toward that particular element. We've been able to achieve that, and that is in progress as well, where the internal auditor are working as a early detection for us in terms of the audit which they are conducting. Also follow up and track our audit findings with the management on a quarterly basis. We have developed a dashboard which we follow up on a quarterly basis. We report to ESCO, and of course also report to our oversight committee, which is the Audit and Risk Committee, being part of the board committee. Key positions are being prioritized to be filled. Certain positions have been filled, and of course one or two still need to be completed. But from the critical ones, we've appointed the CEO, the CFO, as well as the Chief Information Officer. Monthly monitoring, reporting, and management of corrective action plan to ESCO, that is being done on a monthly basis. From our ESCO point of view, we do report on our progress. We need to report to the audit committee progress and address the audit findings for oversight. That's also in progress as well in terms of that particular element. Review the current APP to identify gaps that are required for correction. We used our internal auditors to be able to actually scrutinize our APP and make sure that in terms of the our target, they are all reliable, as well as there's an element of usefulness. And of course, they all meet the SMART criterion as required by the framework of purpose information. Then, of course, produce interim report for the financial statement for pre-audit. This one, I think, is currently underway. We have not yet. We currently have the AG doing the interim audit, and we do believe that the AG coming early will be able to prepare us and then work as a early detection for all areas that we might need to correct prior to submitting as legislated in May. So we're also working on that one as well. In terms of the audited financial statement, if you go to slide 43, in terms of the grants that we have received from the Public Works, we have received a grant of about 73 million. And of course, if you compare to the previous year, we have that decreased from 74 million to about 73. And of course, we do understand that the country is going through a bit of hostility in terms of our finances as a country. So we do appreciate that particular aspect. But then, if you look at revenue from our point of view, which we generate within the CIDB, have slightly increased. We had a budget of about 92 million. However, we achieved about 100 million just on the registration. And of course, if you then compare to the previous year, we have increased from 100 million, from 87 million to 100 million, which is a big, significant in comparison to the previous year. Then the third element of our revenue is on the finance income or the interest which we generate from the bank. We had a budget of about 8 million. However, we superseded that. We achieved about 15 million, and of course, in comparison to the previous year, we have achieved about 14 million, which means that we're able to actually invest the CIDB resources effectively in more efficient manner. Then, if you then come to administrative expenditure, we had a budget of about 72 million. However, we spent a bit of about 78 million. In comparison to our budget, which is a bit of overspending of about 5 million or so. But of course, if you then look at the previous year, that was consistent with the previous year of 78 million as well. Then on personal expenditure, we had a budget for 100 million, and we achieved about 83, we spent about 83 million. The reason why there's a huge variance in terms of between the personal expenditure, between the budget and the actual, is on the fact that I think the chair and the CEO did allude that we are going through an OD, And with that process, many of our positions are not yet filled. As of course, as you will have noted, that within the year, we're able to fill the position of a CFO and a CEO. And as a result, we will then have savings in that particular personal expenditure because some of the positions were not yet filled. And of course, we will then fill them as we roll out the audit. I think if you go to the last slide now, I think the financial position. In terms of the financial position, I think if you're looking at the CIDP, how do we compare in terms of our assets as well as our liabilities? From the asset point of view, I think in the CIDP we do have sort of a very favorable cash and equivalent. We currently, I think, in terms of the total expenditure, about 70% of our asset base is mainly your cash. Your cash equivalent in money in the bank. We have about 241 million in the bank, and that is in comparison to about 212 million in the previous year. Then if you're then looking at your other current asset, we have about 3 or 4 million being receivables, meaning that in terms of our collective collection, we are able to collect more than the previous years. And then if you go look at the fixed asset, from the plant and equipment, we have slightly increased. We have made an investment of about 1 million in comparison to the previous year of about 9 million in tangible asset. And of course, I think the chair did indicate that within the particular period which we currently are reporting under, we invested significantly in our technology. As a result, you see that from the intangible asset point of view, there was sort of an increase of about 4 million or so. It's primarily because of the investment that we were making and which was being capitalized in that aspect. Total asset for the CIDP was about 264 in comparison to the previous year of about 231. Then if you then to go to accumulated surplus being equity, from the equity point of view, it does indicate that from the CIDP point of view, in terms of how we're managing the resources, is quite favorable. We're sitting with about 176 of being accumulated surplus, and that is in comparison to the previous year of about 148, meaning it's about 27 million coming in the balance sheet. And of course, if you go back to your income statement, you then see that, of course, there was that money coming from the income statement, which was then accumulated from the CIDP point of view. It does indicate that despite the hostility, we're still managing very well when it comes to our resources. And of course, on the total current liabilities, we're currently sitting with about 87 million and 82 million, which in terms of your equity ratios and liquidity, it does indicate that from that point of view, we're able to have a sort of a good and a stable liquidity ratios as well as current ratios. If you compare our current liabilities versus our current asset, it does indicate that from the point of view in terms of how we manage the finances, we're currently managing them in a more effective manner. But of course, it's very important to highlight that, as the chair did indicate, that we've taken a view of saying we must actually ensure a proper investment of our resources. A portion of that particular cash and cash equivalent will be invested in CIDP acquiring its own head office within the Gauteng province, and of course that will result in us saving some money from the previous lease that we were servicing in the head office. And of course, what we then do with that particular saving, we then direct it to what the provisional footprint where we also now start investing in ensuring that we provide appropriate accommodation within the provincial space. Thank you.
Thank you. I take that the silence means that the team has accomplished its mission of presentation, which therefore takes me to another level of engagement from honorable members. Mindful of you have noted Honorable Dango, Honorable Tim, Honorable Matewila, and Honorable Boshoff, as the
the Honourable Khaes. Let's start with Honourable Dango.
Thank you, Chairperson. Can they please explain to me how a regulator also becomes a facilitator and a promoter? What is the contradiction, and if there's challenges between that? Because I think if a regulator is a regulator, it looks at that, but it also becomes a promoter. It becomes an issue of probably a conflict somewhere. As if they can just explain that. Also, the excess finances they've got. Why has that not been returned to Treasury as all other entities would at a particular point in time? Why have they an interest on that? They can just explain that.
Thank you very much, Chair and presenter that was presenting. My question, you have mentioned that you have received numbers of complaints regarding the companies. So I just wanted to check if it is possible, even if you cannot answer it now, you can submit to us the breakdown for each and every province, because we work in provinces, the complaints, and also what have you done regarding those complaints. The second one is, I'd like to know which method do you use. For example, if there is a complaint for a certain company who did not build a quality RDP houses as expected, how do you deal with that particular company? Because at some instances you find out the person has not built quality houses in Limpopo, and then he goes and be awarded a tender in Northwest. So I just want to check, how do you monitor them, and what do you do to punish those companies who do such things? Thank you, Chair. Sorry, Chair. And then you have mentioned that there are other companies who are going to start to work in Maputo. So I just wanted to know how many are owned by women in that particular instance. Thank you.
Honorable Basho.
Chair, may I give the first opportunity to our spokesperson on this entity, Tiny Tim, and then I'll follow him. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. I'm quite happy for Honourable Russell to go first, but he's very kindly allowed me to have the first go. Chair, I don't want to go into anything terribly, but I have some concerns. My understanding of the CRDB is that effectively you exist for transformation. Am I right in saying that? I think I am. It's effectively all about transformation. So the question we have to ask ourselves is quota versus quality. Okay. So the question I'm posing to you is CRDB so fixated on quotas in terms of previously disadvantaged persons, women, etc., that we forget about quotas? And this follows on from Honourable Matavula's question. This committee needs to have the assurance from yourselves that you have a definitive monitoring mechanism of where companies get work through the transformation work of the CRDB. And if I can just stop there for a second, I think that's vital work. But as you have seen, it's vital to the point of where engineering takes over. And where a building falls, or a bridge falls in your head, then all the transformation in the world, all the goodwill in the world goes out the window, because people are being killed. And that's, you know, this is serious stuff. So my question is I see this whole report is very, very light on the actual enforcement of engineering standards that are regulated, or so it seems that your regulation is just to make sure that people stay in line with quotas. Where is your regulation? And I'm asking the question, you sent me right. Where is the regulation in terms of companies that have quite rightly been given work, because that's how we need to spread wealth in our country, 100%. But how do we make sure that they are doing the work properly. Onomatopoeia knows exactly what I'm talking about, because we see these projects all the time. In my hometown, Etigrin, the new boardwalk from one point to one point is already falling apart. There are really major cracks in that boardwalk, and it's a fantastic development. It's great for tourism. I'm down there often, and I'm really seeing cracks, big things shifting and all that sort of thing. So my question is, who built it? You know, and your report shows nowhere where you say, we have a list over the last 5 years of X companies that have been tendered work. We have gone 6 months later and see how the work's happening, a year later see how the work's happening. If they are not performing, we've placed them on a blacklist, so they cannot be assisted any further. Do we have a once transformed, always transformed policy? So in other words, does one company get all the work, or do we have a, where we swap it around, where we move it around a bit? Those are the questions I'd like to really get to. In terms of your quality monitoring processes. And then the other question I wanted to ask was, when you're determining the grades, I get very concerned when CRDB grades just change, because they're there for a reason. The grades greatly involve the complexity. Right? So if you're at a 1 to a 9, there's a massive difference in complexity. And whilst I welcome the extension, Deputy Minister, of the amounts that companies can tender for, are we sure that that increase in funds also leaves the contracts at the same complexity? You know, because there's a reason certain contractors are in grade 1 and some are in 9. It's not a hierarchical thing, it's competency. It's the ability to do the work, you know. It's ability to do that work. For example, in my home, I only hire black contractors to do work at my house. I've made a specific point to that. I don't use white companies to do it. But I won't ask those contractors to fix my come and do the tiling and the bricklaying and the plumbing to build the arch at the Moses Mabhida Stadium. Now, that's a ridiculous example. But you know what I'm saying. It's the same kind of thing. The complexity is massively different. So, and I come back to my first question. How is CRDB monitoring the quality of the work done by contractors that CRDB is helping? I'll leave that there and come back in that regard.
Thank you very much, Chair. Speaking of transformation, point four, you mentioned that the high inadequate access to credit seems to be a problem, and that you're looking at a MOA to facilitate the process. At the end of the day, who and how is responsibility going to be taken for the repayment of the loan? Because that must be captured into this MOA so that there's no misunderstanding that CRDB got the loan through a facilitation process and then it's expected of you to repay it. I also feel that transformation with regard to women ownership is very, very lacking. And to host these fantastic breakfasts to engage and maybe interact with potential clients is not getting the right amount of, what would the word be, successes that you're looking for. I would think that one should look at more practical implementation, that workshops are given and spend the money there rather than having these breakfasts. Monitoring and regulating the performance of the industry, including the registration of products and contractors. I have a bit of a problem there. A contractor is appointed and then this contractor subcontracts. Who monitors the subcontractor? Because we find it often that the person that tendered gets the tender, but they're not necessarily competent in what is expected of the tender because of the specifications, and then they subcontract. So who monitors that? And then your employees, your total permanent employees with disabilities, it's shocking. One person. What are you going to do to improve on that? As I mentioned yesterday in our other sitting, the norm, the national norm is 3%, and you're sitting at 0.57%. We need to see an improvement on that, and how are you going to do it? I just want to have a look, Chair. No, I think that's it for now. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Honourable Bishop. Honourable Fayez.
Thank you very much, Honourable Chair. Greetings to the Deputy Minister, Chairperson of the Board, and the entourage of CIB. Chair, I'm not sure then you guide me if the questions I'll be asking have been attended to during the presentation. But I just wish that those will be responding to the question could clarify this issue of quality and competence once and for all, so that black people are not associated with the lack of quality and lack of competences. You know, some of the questions, in a subtle way, they talk to that. That if you have a transformation and you have the black people, then you must be worried about competences and the quality. I hope that CIPD will address those issues once and for all. I just want on the, I would like to go program on administration. I just want to find out what do you mean by other revenue stream. I just want clarity with regard to that particular issue. On program regulation and advocacy, I'm not sure. For me, compliance is supposed to be 100% here. Why do we have a target of 65% instead of 100%? Why do we have regulations that must be complied to, but then you have a target of 65% in terms of compliance, not 100%? I did not have an opportunity. I normally don't rely on the PowerPoint presentation. I normally go for the book, the annual report itself. But unfortunately, I didn't have that opportunity because I know when you do PowerPoint presentation, you want to be as flowery as possible and leave out some of the things that are in the book itself. And therefore, I sometimes rely on the research work that is done by our parliamentary researchers. I see there's something from the researchers' point of view under the development and capacitation, a target of 1,000 learners. I didn't pick up in the presentation itself, but I picked it up in the research document of the researchers. And the target was 1,000, but in terms of the achievement, it's only 118 learners. That is very low in terms of the target that was set. I also align myself with the Honorable Matevola. As you know, that in the NCOP we focus on provinces. So it will be good if, for example, on the issue of registration of projects that on and also the grading or designation that we have a breakdown in terms of the provinces. Similarly, with regard to the the business advisory services. I know there are names of provinces that have been mentioned, but if you can also put numbers to each of the provinces as well. She touched on the issues of investigation on the infringement of the code of conduct. I think one of the critical vacancies that we mentioned is that of the CEO, and it says that by March, if I understand it properly, the presentation, that by March we'll have a CEO. Do we have a CEO now, or we don't? Because in terms of what I looked at in the presentation, it gives an impression that the deadline will be March, so by now, so therefore by March we'll have the CEO. But I also wanted to check with regard to the Chief Information Officer, but also it was said by the end of 2019-2020, which is also ending in March, the institution would have the Chief Information Officer. I did not pick up, I understand in the presentation it is said that the institution got unqualified audit opinion, but as I was indicating, I didn't look at the auditor's statement, auditor general part of the report. I wanted to check whether there were any irregular expenditure, fruitless and wasteful expenditure, or are there any fraud cases that the institution is dealing with. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Whip?
Thank you, Chair. From my side, I just want clarity on issue, because most of the speakers have covered in the issue of grading designation. My personal view, it is little but too low. Is there a plan
on it, or is this just how we continue the grading designation? It's at 51,000, but the level one is 43,000, which we know half of that is not even getting work, if not more. So, meaning we are talking about plus minus 8,000 is the balance, and that is the 8,000 sharing the cake, because that is the system. You need to be registered for you to get anything on the system. So we can't even go to that method of saying when someone gets a sub, the person who got the job is the one who cannot do the job, because the criteria is already high for you to get that specific rating for you to get the job. The main company, when it gets the job, it is on a grading level which is required by the department or the institution, 5 or 6, whatever. So the subcontractors, for it to subcontract means it does not have the required grading. So it then went for subcontract. So the one who gave, it can be many reasons. So the narrative of saying it does not have the skills. No, maybe they have a lot of work. Maybe they have too many projects. Maybe because of this system that only 8,000 is from level 2 up to level 9. Your vision is very clear. It starts with transformation. But I feel that we are lacking, because if you divide this number from 6 up to 9 and you divide it by provinces, it's a possibility you get some provinces getting 1 or 2. That is a sad reality, and it is exist. So we need to come up with methods from your side. How do we transform the industry at a better scale? I admire and thank you for the one of where you say from 500 to 1 million now for level 1. That is a good point, because the third part we must also know, most of the work from level 1 and 2 sometimes are not advertised. It's never advertised. So it sometimes go on three quotations, it sometimes go on closed tender, but it is not advertised. So it's not an easy case for people outside. It's not an easy case. So the reason we don't have the 43,000, I see you start by level 2 of companies that maybe fall back. You start from level 2, because if you go from level 1, you'll have to say half of it fall back or lose the accreditation of 1, because they don't get any job. Most of the people open 3 to 4 companies just to survive, and they don't get work with that 3 to 4 companies because they are all at level 1. So my point is very clear. I just want to know clearly, how do you going to focus on your vision of transformation? That's all. I don't want a lot of issues, and I want the one that the two previous speakers, the leader from, the honorable member from EFF and also the previous speaker, where you put it to provinces. It will be very detailed so that it can clearly say to us what is happening, because it's a serious, this one is a serious shock. Not to blame you, no one's blaming you. It's a crisis for all of us. Because when you go to the provinces and you realize how people struggle to submit, and after they submit, still sometimes it depends on the person there. Some people give good services, some does not help the people, they are tired. So you end up those people that could have had hope waiting for documents that was not filled right half of the year. So those are the small things, but maybe you answered us on your IT issue. I think that IT issue, when you do things more advanced, will help us. Thank you. And, just to add, the numbers, some of these numbers must become more visible. Even the president's number is visible. When there's problems, people must be able to talk to some of you. Please, it has to happen. Because there are serious problems in these institutions, province by province, region by region. We need to talk to you. Thank you.
General Lansman, Honorable Chief, I saw your hand again.
Yes. Chair, I just wanted to clarify my question earlier. It is not in any way, shape or form founded in any sort of racial undertone. I understand that you're... I understand and I apologize if it's taken that way. I stand for this. Any construction undertaken in the public sector must conform to to certain qualities and engineering standards so that our infrastructure doesn't break, that we get value for money, but most importantly, that our infrastructure doesn't kill people. That's what I stand for, no matter who it is. If it's a white company, an Indian company, a colored company, a black company, I'm asking the CIDB, how do they enforce engineering standards across who they assist? That's what I'm talking about. But I'm certainly not saying anybody gets a free ride. If you've committed criminal acts in terms of your poor construction, you need to go to jail. If you have not given government and the taxpayer value for money, we need to claim civilly from you. It's got nothing to do with race. It's got to do with quality. That's my sole question was, is CIDB able to help with quality or not? That's all I want to know. Thank you.
Honorable
Kai?
Oh, I thought you raised your hand. You're fine. Thank you. That's just two from me, Deputy Minister. The capacity in all your provincial offices. Can we also tend to say that indeed there's capacity that will be able to take forward
your stated objectives in terms of all the programs that you have outlined before us. Particularly given your importance in terms of regulating the industry, but more than that, in terms of transformation imperatives, I think it's important that that we up our game. Given the fact that in most cases, where the requirement of an advert is nine, you go there, you'll get a skewed picture of those that are attending there if the required grading is grade 9 at the site briefing. And that in itself, it can't be correct after 25 years of new government. So I think it's important that I think there is a concerted drive to change that skewed picture. And it has to also be inclusive of this drive by the president of the district model. It means, I think, there has to be an equal distributional focus in terms of growth transformation at district level. The second point relates to the proclamations that was signed by the president on the SIU. I think in the first administration, if I'm not mistaken. Any reflection on that? So that at least there's a sense that indeed that proclamation is yielding results. Is anyone going to change or not? But the last one relates to the collusion of certain major contractors during the 2010. I think the Competition Commission was able to isolate that. Did we downgrade any other companies emanating from that finding of the Competition Commission? And lastly, I'm just worried about your quest to have your own. Of course, I suspect it could be an attempt to disassociate yourself or disestablish yourself from the mother department that is exercising oversight over you. Your lease transfer in terms of office building, given the economic climate. Are you not contributing to probably to the growth of your overhead cost? I think it's an aspect that, to me, I think you should be looking into it. Thank you, Deputy Minister.
Thanks, Chairperson. Normally, I would allow them to deal with the technical and operational questions first, so that we come back with the political ones. So I will allow the team.
Thank you, Honourable Members and DM. The questions are quite sizable. Both in number and in gravity. So obviously we will have to split them amongst ourselves, and we haven't done any exercise to do that. So forgive us, therefore, if we go backwards and forwards. But
can I just ask one question, the last one? Why is all the team here, other than the chair, and the chair, the woman, and then the management team is 100% me. Thank you.
Chairperson, I think it's a good question. We will let the mail speak to it. Thank you very much for the questions. The more technical questions obviously will go to the executive management, and the less technical and probably strategic questions we will deal with as non-executives. So just on the first question, are we a regulator, a promoter, a facilitator? Is there a conflict amongst the roles? And I would add, is the conflict so tenuous that we can't perform one role as against the other? Our response would be yes, at face value, yes, absolutely, there is a conflict in, maybe not conflict, but tension between the roles of facilitating and developing vis-a-vis regulating. But I think that tension does not emanate from here. It goes back all the way to the legislation, because the legislation gives us both responsibilities. You can't develop without being able to facilitate. You can't develop without being able to promote. So the developmental aspect of our mandate from the legislation speaks to the facilitation and promotion and related nouns that support development. So that's the one aspect. The regulatory, on the other hand, ordinarily you would have been a regulator independent of everything else. I think our history puts us here where we have to then ensure that there's regulation. And on the technical aspect, which I think the Honourable Member was also speaking about, have focus on the technical aspects of the business. And sometimes when you have that aspect of hardcore technical regulation, without necessarily taking into account where our country is at in terms of development, that's where the two roles sometimes collide. But their collision, in our view, is not collision that makes us makes it for us impossible to perform. I think the colleagues will illustrate as we move forward in an attempt to respond to this question. But I think it's a necessary tension, and it's a tension that I think comes all the way from the Constitution to where we are. And I think we are trying the best we can to live with the two areas that are sometimes tenuous in themselves. Insofar as why do we have cash reserves that are not returned to National Treasury, we do not hide what we have. We account to National Treasury, we report on a quarterly basis, and all the way to, obviously, at the end of the year. We apply for retention of funds, which we call rollovers, as the member will know, and those rollovers are not done willy-nilly. National Treasury is aware of predominantly four things that we had said we were going to do, and time has not necessarily been on our side. One, we had said we were going to do organizational design. We've done that, but that's a very long process that one has to go through. So they appreciate that that process takes time. Two, the issue of accommodation. That too, National Treasury understands the processes that must go before you even go out to the public to procure space, what needs to go before that. And we've done all those analyses and working in part very much with National Treasury in undergoing those processes, which is why they can understand what the money is reserved for. Thirdly, the ICT that we spoke about earlier, that too was budgeted for. But if you don't have the right numbers in the right positions, you are not able to procure space, but you are also not able to procure support systems, which are your IT systems. And insofar as interests that we earn from those monies, we've been transparent about where the interest is, how much we are earning, and where the interest goes. So all of that, I think, is happening within an appropriate governance process between ourselves as the board and the CIDP, as well as ourselves and National Treasury. And we are comfortable that we are getting the right support that we need. Okay, so to add the element of the chair's question to the question that I've just
responded to just a little bit in terms of why go on leases when we could be accommodated. I know the question is for the DM, I don't know, but insofar as our response to that question, which is also related to the question that was raised earlier, insofar as that aspect is concerned, it hasn't been our own initiative as the CIDB, but all good things, I did say earlier, do come to an end. So our relationship with our mother department got to a point because of their own needs, space needs, and our own space needs. Their needs were irreconcilable. So obviously, they first have to take care of themselves before they take care of us. So in essence, that's the key reason. They needed the space. We were holding back the space that they needed. And so there's no, to our knowledge, anything further than that, other than the issue of needs.
Jefferson, just to not, excuse me, if the two of us leave to go to another meeting, is there enough members to pass the minutes and things like that, Shepard?
Is that 12 from by 12, ne? By 10 to 12. Okay. Let's see how far we can go in terms of repeating this question. I think the numbers are there, but let's see how far we can go.
Okay. I will leave to my colleagues to hurry up. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you very much, Chair. Just another question also from the Chair there. It was the issue of the own head office. Currently, we actually don't rent our head office from the department. We are actually renting it from SABS. And they are charging us something close to $700,000 a month. You know, so it just didn't make sense, you know, looking at our growth as well. You know, the buildings are just not enough. And we also think that we can get better value, you know, if we can explore outside. And in some of the provinces as well, it's not that we also rent only from the department. We rent from different parties, you know. Some from provincial government, some from the national government, you know, etc. So what then happens is that when they need space, like in the Free State, I think we have been kicked out three times, and you know, so I think we can't now for the third time say we haven't made a plan. So we actually have to make plans because they need that space, you know, and we have been delaying them in that way. So that's really why we went away. We are going away from there. Right, there was a question from about complaints, which is and those complaints needed to be broken down into provinces. I think we don't have anything of hand now, but we can actually do some work to give that breakdown and send to the committee. Also, there was a mention of the issue of quality, of how do we monitor the quality of contractors in the province, because there may be some serial offenders who would give poor quality in one province and then run to another one. I think in terms of that, I think first of all, I think it's very important to actually understand the role of CIDB in the execution of projects, so that we can actually assign responsibilities fairly in between the clients as well as CIDB. What we do as CIDB is that we actually provide a framework, you know, for achieving the quality, and also the framework of making sure that people can deal with the work which is in line with their competencies.
So in fact, the tender value limits, you know, as we see there on the board, they are actually designed such that, you know, they sort of match the amount of work as well as the competency of a person. Because how do you determine a level? You determine a level by asking how much work the person has done before. And you interrogate that, you know, and the value of work, you know, et cetera, and. So in other words, the limits there, they are a method of actually making sure that people take what they can chew. Now, the second part, which is also the most important part of CIDP, is that we have what we call a code of conduct. Now, the code of conduct is now what we use to enforce the behavior, the expected behavior, if it is actually deviated upon. Now, when that happens, unfortunately, most of that is something which should come to us as a complaint, you know, because we actually don't have a view of everything, you know. We have, you know, I don't know how many municipalities we have, but lots of municipalities. So when they are doing the work, we don't necessarily have the view. So, you know, contractors themselves can put a complaint. The clients themselves, either the departments or the municipalities, can put a complaint about a specific contractor. And then that is actually when we then take charge in terms of disciplining that contractor. But that is done in terms of the code of conduct. Now, we must also know that with contractors, I mean, so therefore the issue of quality, in fact, rests with the client, you know. It also rests with the client. In fact, there is something which you saw there which we didn't meet, which we introduced, the performance rating by clients, you know. So we designed a performance rating for the client so that they can rate the contractors themselves. But the problem is that the clients themselves, you know, are very slow or not very eager to do that. So now as CIDP, we need to say, how do we now try to force the clients to give us the quality of the work done by those contractors so that we can have a view, and therefore that view we can make it public. You know, so the unfortunate part is that there is that relationship between CIDP and the clients. So that is really how we take care of issues of quality. We are not direct, we are indirect, but we are in the process of doing that. There was also a question about the trip to Maputo, where we're introducing South African contractors to Mozambique, and how many are women owned. We don't have statistics at hand, but we will look at that and give the comment. Is there anything I've left on that first question? Okay. Right. The second question was about, you know, this issue of quantity versus quality. Which was saying that we are almost fixated on quotas, and also we need to have a definitive monitoring mechanisms for quality, you know, and enforcing engineering standards. But I think I've already touched on that as CIDP, we provide the framework. But the actual work has to be done by clients, and they also need to be transparent to CIDP. Now, even the registration of contracts, you know, not all departments, even government departments, comply. Not all municipalities comply. So our job as CIDP is to try and improve that compliance.
You know, now what we have been thinking, for instance, was to say, look, we can actually now give a report to the public, including this committee, of those departments, municipalities, etc., who are not complying. You know, because that is the source of the problem, is that the people who are supposed to comply with the prescripts and legislation of CIDP, they don't. You know, so we're in the process of doing that. But in terms of quality, as we have seen, you know, we've started making sure that there are mechanisms to make that quality transparent. Now, also one of the things which we've been trying to enforce is that when you register a contract, for instance, when you actually now complete the contract, you must also tell CIDP that the contract is complete. You know, so those are the ways and means of us trying to make sure that there is that transparency in terms of completion, in terms of quality. So we do have a code of conduct, and one of the things in the code of conduct which is important is things like discharge duties and obligations timely and with integrity. So if there is a complaint from anybody that hasn't happened, we enforce that as CIDP. Now, comply with all legislation and associated regulations. So in terms of engineering standards, you have engineering standards which are legislated and you have to comply in a certain way. So if there is a complaint which you have to attend to and the person has not complied, we then sanction that particular person. And there was also a concern about grade changes, you know. Now, we want to assure this committee that you don't easily change from one grade to the other. You know, there is a due process whereby, you know, we look at many things before we actually change the grades, you know. The only thing which has happened in the past now is that many contractors, even grade 8 and 9 contractors, you found that in terms, because one of the criteria is the amount of work which you have done over the last period. Let's say it's a 3-year period. So if you haven't done a certain amount of work, then you get downgraded. Now what we have done is, what the stakeholders have asked us to say, look, the economic climate is very bad. So we haven't really been able to get enough work, not because of our fault, but because of the environment. Therefore, we've put in a moratorium of downgrading, you know, but obviously it's not indefinite, you know. So we haven't downgraded, but because of the low economic climate as well, upgradings are very few because people are not getting enough work to warrant them to be upgraded. So in terms of going up, you go up because one, you know, you are able to do a certain amount of work successfully because that is the condition, etc. So it's not just pushing people up. Now, the fourth question was about transformation in terms of credit access. Now, there was a concern that CIDP can be liable in that process. We will make sure that we're not liable in that process. But in fact, the most of credit houses, when they work with contractors, they work on, what is the basis called? It's a session basis. So in other words, they protect themselves. They actually have an agreement which goes right up to the person who's giving the work, the client. So in other words, when the client has to pay the contractor, they actually have to pay their obligation first to the lender. So the lender is always protected. So ours is to just facilitate that in terms of access, but we have no obligations whatsoever in that one. The other one was the issue of women ownership, that it is lacking. Just having a breakfast doesn't make more women contractors. We agree with that. We will be looking at workshops The first step was to, you know, have that breakfast, understand the issues, and workshops was one of the things which was suggested from the doctor.
Deal with one aspect before we run out of quorum. I just want us to deal with the minutes because we can't deal with the minutes before once we are less than five provinces in this meeting. You're fine. Honourable members, let's just go to the minutes of the 12th of February, which was a presentation by the Public Service Commission on its annual report on the 12th of February 2020. The first page deals with those that attended the committee meeting. And the guests that we had that day, and the staff. And then on page two, it is the opening and welcome remarks, apologies, proceedings, and the comments that were made in deliberations. Is there any correction that Honourable Moss would want to make, both on page one and page two? That's the... move to page three. I want to believe that you had an opportunity to go through the minutes. Any correction, Honourable Members? I take that there's no corrections to be made. In terms of the report, I want to believe that the Secretary circulated to all of us the reports that that were requested last week on the 12th. From that meeting, I've seen the reports last week. Can we then get a mover for the adoption of the minutes, Honourable Tim, and then seconded by Honourable Lansman? So therefore, the minutes are adopted from page one up to page four. In terms of it's just an acknowledgement on the last page that spoke to the joint management meetings decisions. There is progress around this task and the responsible officials that is unfolding. With that, can we then go back to the CEO response to the questions? Thank you. My indulgence, Honourable Deputy Minister.
Thank you very much, Chair. I was on women ownership and workshops. That is on our cards to have a lot of workshops, and we try and make sure that we interact with our clients when we conduct those workshops, so that we can achieve what is required. There was also the issue of mentoring of contractors and subcontractors, and the question is that who mentors the subcontractor? Now, the contractor who actually gets the job is liable for the work to be done. So if the work goes wrong, I mean, the main contractor takes the rap. Therefore, the mentoring of the subcontractors is left to the contractor himself, because he has that liability. And if you look at the history of engineering, that's how things have happened, you know, so nothing has really changed. Now, employees with disabilities, we are definitely not proud of our statistics there, and it's something we endeavor to improve going forward. The next question was also on quality and competence, and it was mentioned that there shouldn't be an association of black with incompetence necessarily, and I think, you know, somehow it was also dealt with, on the floor as we were moving forward. The other one was registration advocacy. There was something at 65%. Yeah, if you can just take compliance with regulation at 65%. I think it's one of
them. Okay, so the particular one, there is one target, not a 65, there's an 85% target related to the provincial officers. So the provincial officers play a role in terms of their part of the process. Currently, the system is such that the provincial officers start the process, they do data capture, and head office then actually does the assessment and review. Now, our chair and CEO spoke about the organizational design. An assessment was done. It was found that the mode of operation is not suiting contractors, because when a contractor walks into a provincial office, you actually can't get the full picture. You've got this head office sitting somewhere, and you want to talk to people that can help you where you're located. So the organizational design is now, we've created a change in our service where the actual assessment happens at the provincial offices. So that target we're using currently is in the mode of operation that we're replacing, where they, for example, just had some data capture targets to feed into your overall targets. But going forward, we're actually looking at the provincial offices taking the full suite of registration there. So the 85% was their contribution to the 21 days, because they had part of the responsibility only, and we're going to move the full responsibility there.
Thank you, Chair. In terms of the revenue streams, the other revenue streams will refer to other revenues that we do not generate from government, being the grant. Primarily, if you're looking at CIDP's financial statement, we have two main revenue streams, being what we generate from the registration of contractors, and of course we also make money from the interest that we have received from our investment. I think also the chair did indicate that the interest that we receive is aligned to our own act, which does permit the board to be able to use or invest surplus in the best manner for the company.
There was also a question about 100 Lennon, which is a target.
Yeah, no, I got it. Thank you. So the 1,000 learners, here the target was actually related to workplace learning opportunities where learners can then be placed at departments and actually get experience there, in terms of the learning, so the practical experience. What we actually found was that there was a lack of, responsiveness from departments in which we would want to place those learners. So the corrective action going forward is a few very key issues. I think the one that we must state that's very important is the pending regulation amendments on the best practice project assessment fee. And the reason why that's critical is that, or how that system works, is yes, there's a register of contractors and a register of projects, but there's also the second phase of these registers that promotes performance improvement and development. Specifically, how this is designed to work is that the projects above a certain threshold are enrolled in a scheme called a project assessment scheme. There's a fee that's to be paid with that, and in terms of that, that then unlocks our development support strategy. That development support strategy then involves skills development, because the CDB has already published a standard for skills development. How that works is that once the project is enrolled in the project assessment scheme, the skills development standard must be applied. And how that is applied is that X percent of that project value goes towards skill development. So the answer there is then that the target was there. There was an unwillingness not adequate responsiveness for absorption of those learners. We've now got regulations that already went for past the Gazette process already, public comment, it's closed already. It's sitting with the minister, and there's interest expressed by the minister and deputy minister on prioritizing the best practice fee regulations that will unlock the development support strategy.
in vain there on that question if we can exhaust it. There was also the issue about the CEO and CIO. There was no clarity whether those people have been appointed, but we can assure you that they have been appointed already, you know, before March. There was also a question about irregular and fruitless and wasteful expenditure. CFO.
Thank you, CCO. In terms of the irregular expenditure as well as the fruitless and wasteful expenditure, we did not incur any in the 2018-19 financial year. So there was no irregular expenditure that we incurred, no fruitless or wasteful expenditure.
And then on the issues of the grading that we have is too low, basically it speaks to all the issues of subcontractors and low values, and it speaks to the issues of transformation. So I'm going to just attempt to respond to that question in the following sense. We will provide, of course, written information if I may just clarify on which of the issues that were raised. We were required to provide a breakdown of registration per province. We'll provide that in writing. Breakdown of advisory services per province, we will provide that. And obviously, how issues of discipline in the sector, how have we dealt with that? We request if we be given an opportunity to provide that in writing as well. But just generally, that the grading is too low, perhaps it speaks to the earlier response that was articulated by the CEO. We agree that we need people in high grades, but we also recognize that there has to be the technical know-how before a company moves to the next grade, because our responsibility as the CIDB is not only for the contractors to be progressed, but we have a responsibility towards clients so that clients realize value for the services that are rendered by contractors. And in doing that, we can't act in an irresponsible manner of just pushing people up the grades only. We have to balance and provide a full service that a client expects under those circumstances. So this question will probably also just provide a little bit of clarity in writing on how the grading system works. So that I think there is clarity. Honourable members, on issues of contact numbers, I don't even think it's a matter of should or should they not be. They are there. We have contact numbers. People do contact me, do contact any members of the board. They also do contact employees. But we also have standard numbers that are provided for contractors. And of course, with social networks, I think it has become even easier for people to communicate. But I think we need to do more than that. And through our stakeholder engagement processes, we also engage with stakeholders per province and sometimes per region within provinces, because we want to encourage people to come forward not only on complaints but also on suggestions on how we can improve our business and therefore their existence as contractors. Then we move to the issues pertaining to, and of course included in this question is the discussion where the chairperson was saying we have very limited grade 9. It's a concern of ours. But perhaps, and I'm not sidestepping the question or apportioning blame or anything like that, but for anyone to get to a grade 9, it's a function of a real project on the ground that a person or a company has done. The experience in the CV you get only through doing projects on the ground. Unfortunately, the past
many years after 2010, we haven't seen real big projects that would have enabled that capacity to grow and develop. And I think we must recognize that. Otherwise, the CIDB will be in big trouble if we suddenly saw many grade nines and yet there were no contracts on the ground. How would those grade nines have come into existence? So I think if we look at it that way, is a grading equals work equals an upgrade, and that's the only simplest way one can put it. I fully agree that we have to support what the president is doing and build capacity on the ground. So the district model, in our response, we should be able to provide, and probably to your honor, honorable members, in advance, because certainly in other districts you will see that there is a whole lot of lack in terms of engineering and all of that. But I might just want to clarify two things related to that. Each client appoints an engineer. Normally the client's engineer is the person that must ensure that work happens. So do take that into account when you read our reports. But what I am warning in advance is that there are regions, there are provinces where you have a whole lot less engineering capacity, a whole lot less construction capacity, especially from grade 6 upwards. Grade 1s and 2s, they are there everywhere, because those are grades that are not going to change the world in the short term. They will in the medium to long term. So then the other question was, So perhaps before I finish this president's district model philosophy, what we need to do as the CIDB internally is to then go back and say, with this capacity dispersed as it is, are we able to put hand in heart and say we can provide the support? It's not an answer we can give to this meeting. I don't even think we'll be able to give it in writing in the short term, but we are going to go back and work and then provide a response in the medium to long term. Then on the question of the proclamations on the SIU, has anyone been arrested and in jail yet? No, definitely not. Have we found a whole lot of what we did not know before the proclamation? Not quite. What the SIU have investigated, I'm talking about what they have shared with us. I'm not talking about what they haven't shared with us. So what they've shared with us is what we already knew, that there were problems there and problems there. They've investigated, they've provided further clarity, but it hasn't quite changed our world from knowing what we did not know that much. We still anticipate that they'll give us something. We, as the board now, we raised a concern with the SIU, both in writing and in meetings. We've raised a concern that there is a huge bill that we are paying, but from a, do we know anything better? Are we able to put anyone in jail? We haven't quite. So the expectation of the proclamation and what we've received have not yet matched, but the financial cost to the CIDB has been quite astronomical. And that's what we are trying to manage between ourselves and the SIU. And I think it's a fair thing, because we as the board, we are the accounting authority for the organization. So we need to know not what we are paying for, but is what we are paying for value? So that's what we are preoccupied with as the board. We are not saying they must stop, but we are saying we haven't seen what we thought we were going to see. Can the bill be commensurate to what we've seen? So that's a high-level summary without going into detail change. That said, we also said it's inconceivable that this thing could be going on for much longer. Can you let us know, from your perspective as the SIU, how much more time do you need? They then gave us March 2020, so we are a month away from that. So we hope to close that, but it's not closed by us, because the proclamation is not ours. It's that of the Honorable President. So we hope they will close around that time around March. And whatever they've brought to us, because you might ask, so that which they gave you, what did you do with it? Where we needed to have strengthened our systems, we have done that as much as possible, but obviously, as we indicated earlier, our systems were vulnerable at a particular point in time, which is why we wanted to strengthen our ICT systems in particular. But there were also human issues, and those human issues where people needed to be dealt with have been dealt with. But those infractions were not at the level at which they were, call it, prosecutable. I don't know whether that's the right English, but anyway, that's what I'm trying to communicate. And then the area where we would say, as the CIDB board, and I'm perhaps speaking for the board at this point, we are in part embarrassed about is this collusion issue. So, Chair, do not ask us more details on it. Not that you shouldn't, but we are not able to provide that much more detail on the collusion matter. But this is just a high level. The high level is that we had those companies that were found to have colluded. They then entered into an agreement with government. So that took us out of the picture, except to monitor the implementation of that agreement. And insofar as the monitoring, more predominantly, whether what was supposed to have been paid into the trust was indeed paid. So that's the one aspect. So what we need to do is to strengthen that. We are engaging to ensure with the trustees, and of course to be assisted by the department on how far that is taking place. But in terms of any other additional actions under the ones that were found, we have not done anything. We are not expected to do anything except strengthen our own internal processes, which in terms of the code of conduct, we've gone back to the code of conduct and we've strengthened that. Now, in terms of those that had not agreed that they had behaved in a collusive manner, in terms of those, there's that group. So we've been toing and froing between them and threats of court actions on their side and on our side, but we haven't made significant progress. And we will indicate in part, not that it's an absolute limitation, because it isn't, but it contributes to the limitations. The original agreement, which the VRP agreement, is what almost took away the oomph out of the CIDB, because it went straight to challenging our the strength of our regulations and related issues on the one aspect, and on the other, it also the contention that the perceived colluders for the alleged colluders, for a lack of a better description, is that you are giving us different treatment. There was this group that you gave a particular treatment, and you are now giving us different treatment. I don't think as the country we were ready for that. I don't think as the CIDB we were ready for that large-scale collusion. Therefore, we didn't have mechanisms that were very specifically designed to deal with the collusion. So, where's the embarrassment? The embarrassment is on the latter. We haven't made significant progress. We accept that. We accept the criticism. But it's not that we are treating them any differently. It's just our regulatory mechanism has been a bit of a limiting factor for us as the CIDB. And then males against females, or the absence of females in our team. It's one area that, as the board, we've been at serious conversation on. We've gone back to look at, was it the requirements? What was it that made people not respond? For at least two positions, we paused the process and we took it out again. We identified targeted women who we thought could potentially apply. Even those who did apply did not come to the party as much as they were expected to in terms of the requirements we had put in the job profile and or specs, and so it's something that we are talking about, but it's not for anyone to blame necessarily. It's just, I think, what was in the market and what we received at that particular point in time is what we ended up with. We're very happy with the people we appointed. I'm not saying this in any negative way. We're extremely happy with the people who were appointed, but we still believe there are women out there, so we are working on different strategies to go and target more specifically women for the for the remaining positions. We don't know whether we will get everybody that we are looking for. I don't mean per person, but I mean gender. But it's something that the board is very preoccupied with. Thank you very much, Chairman.
To come back to the collusion, are we talking about the 2010 collusion?
Yes.
That's what we're talking about. And they have been penalized? They've agreed to pay a penalty? Are those companies still liable? Could they still get contracts in the future? But let me ask a second question as well, not related to that. The question of monitoring and quality is important. But sometimes a thing can look aesthetically good. There was an experience where there was a very nice building of another nice project, aesthetically good, but they didn't put any brick force in. And because there was no brick force in there, when the wet weather came, there was a rising damp. And the rising damp created a problem. So is that being measured? Very carefully, that kind of thing.
Thank you.
Firstly, I just want to, on this issue of the alternate revenue stream, I just like to say, said we must align the strategic objectives to the target. Mm-hmm. We can talk about 75% in terms of the strategic objective, but then on the annual target, you take rents and cents. Now, it's confusing for us whether the 75%, which is the strategic objective, has been realized, because when you set the annual target, there's no percentage now, it's just rents and cents. So there should be alignment between the strategic objectives and the target. That's one point. The other one, I've just got now the book itself, just gone through it. I just want to be assisted by the CFO on page 90, under the item under 29, irregular expenditure. If you can assist me to just clarify for me what that page means. Then, sorry, just before that, because I think the other one also will have to be responded to by yourselves, on page 80, page 80, contingent assets. I'm not going to read what is there, but you can read it, and perhaps if you can clarify for us how far is that process that is stated in the document itself. Those are the three areas I just wanted clarity on. So, yeah.
You? CFO?
Thank you, Chair. I think on page 90, the irregular expenditure. I think if you look at the that submission, you
for the current year, there was no irregular expenditure. But from the previous years, which comes from other years, there was irregular expenditure which was being carried through. But remember, in terms of financial trade recognition on the irregular expenditure, up until that particular irregular expenditure has been condoned by National Treasury, you are bound and you are required to disclose it. And at the time when submitting the financial statement, that irregular expenditure, which was coming from, I think, three years ago, was the opening balance, was not condoned. But however, in 2019-20, it has been condoned, and we have no irregular expenditure. As they say, so we did not incur any new irregular expenditure. So on the page 80, if I may just quickly go there. Okay, the court case, I think, is still underway. We are still engaging with those particular employees. What happened is that there was an employee who had received a certain benefit in terms of the leaves, which they then prior to serving a notice, they then resigned. We're taking that matter to court. We're still engaging with a particular process. The matter went to the Pension Adjudication Committee, and unfortunately, when the ruling was given, it was given against the CITP to say, based on the particular prescripts as well as regulations and local pension act, we were not able to retain that money from the pension point of view. We are busy with that process. We're going to be making submission to the CEO to look at the causes of benefit, if it's going to be worth it, why for the CITP to involve in a prolonged legal backlash, and which would not come at cost, or take a position on how to treat that asset. Maybe we might actually be forced to revisit it and write it off based on the Pension Adjudication Committee's ruling.
In terms of the collusion, the actual VRB, the actual agreement between the companies and government dictated the terms in which those companies can continue moving forward. And the short answer is yes, those companies can get work. But the reality, as our chair has said, is that the monitoring role of CADB is, you know, we're playing a bigger role on that, and there's been a lot of movements there. Also related to that is the fact that there is, you know, we need to be cognizant there's a lot of restructuring that has happened actually at that level. Some of the companies are no longer existing in the way that we knew them. And other ones have done some restructuring. There's some business rescue that has taken place as well. Sometimes the intentions are good. Other times the intentions are, you have to question the reason for that restructuring that's taking place. So the answer is that the actual terms of the VRB dictates whether those companies can get work. If I may also use the platform while I'm on that, there was a question earlier that we didn't answer related to, of the companies in the export promotion, how many were women companies? So of the seven in the export promotion, three companies were women contractors as well. Then in terms of the performance issue, the recent question, there's a few things that we need to raise here. One is that the actual CIDB legislation does provide for performance reports on contractors. CIDB developed performance reporting so that how essentially it will work is that contractors will build up a performance score. And so over time, when clients are evaluating tenders, you can actually look at the performance score of contractors. But what also came out strongly is that sometimes or often it's not just the contractor's fault in terms of performance. Sometimes there's issues related to the client practice and sometimes the client representative's practice that actually affects contractors. So what's been happening in parallel is performance reports development for client departments and professional providers. So on a project you actually rate the client and the contractor and the client's the professional as well. So that's work that is underway. I think I'll stop there.
Thank you.
Chairperson, just to conclude on issues of development, because I think there were many questions around issues of development. There are two things in the main that we would want to put on record. On an ongoing basis, there is some training and development that is offered by the CIDB or offered by the CIDB through other people that we engage to offer that training and development. There is that. But what is happening is that that is not enough to meet the demand, especially when you talk about grade 1, 2, the lower grades, maybe, if I can focus that way, because they are very large in number, they are very dispersed all over the country, so it's what we, and therefore from a resource point of view, the CIDB does become very stretched. So in terms of what we were talking about a little earlier when, I think it's, when we were talking about the best practice fee, the best practice fee is intended to help us almost springboard training and development so that we are able to train so that and give consistent training per grade, because that's what we train here, we train on the financial management, we train on this, we train on that, but the training is not consolidated so that anyone who walks out of that program can manage a construction business and deal with the risks associated and have the right systems to manage their businesses. So what we are trying to do, and we're very hopeful, we're close to that, because that will address the questions that were raised by the Honourable Member that has taken leave, simply because our focus from protecting government and protecting the clients, we have to ensure that the contractors who do the work up to including completion. Now, the challenge that we are having is that people are able to manage up to a particular point, they run out of funds, they liquidate, you get new people. That is why, in part, I'm not saying that's the only reason, but that is why, in part, you find that a project that starts being a billion rand, okay, I won't say it ends up being 18 billion because that will be an exaggeration, but it never concludes at the same rate in terms of cost. And what the only way we can deal with that in a manner that is effective, and not just us as the CIDB alone, but including clients, is to all get in one room, get proper training on how we manage budgets, how contractors manage budgets, how clients manage contractors, and how we regulate. Because unless we take that role as a composite whole, we are always going to say someone hasn't done something and someone hasn't done another, and to the detriment of the country and the detriment of economic growth. Thank you very much, Chairperson.
Deputy Minister.
Thank you, Chairperson. Chair, we first must indicate that with respect to transformation and access, there's work that we are doing with Treasury as a department, which I think at some point we will have to come back here to take the honourable members on board in terms of trying to delineate first. In fact, let me rather say, as the department, we're trying to delineate the responsibilities of the various bodies that we have. You had a slide there that was talking about learners and what CIDP is doing with respect to that. Limited as it has been shown, CPE, which is also an entity of the department, is doing also some work in that respect of ensuring that there's facilitation and development of learners into engineers. But the truth of the matter, as a nation, is that the rate at which, as a country, we are producing engineers is dismal. We're producing 1 engineer per 2,600 people. Yet the average internationally is 1 engineer per 40 people. Now that's not incomparable. What? We can't compare it with anything. Incomparable. It means we need to change our approach. Because we will talk about the work of CIDP. That work is at this level. If you do not change from the source, it's going to be very difficult to change at the top. Because CIDP comes in at a space and at a time when companies are already set up and operational. But you need skilled personnel to ensure that the quality of the work produced is the right kind of quality and. So we are now reorienting our bodies so that we know that the focus for development of skill lies here. The focus on development of companies and the grading lies here, so that one is able to interface with the other. But currently, you find them, I don't want to use the word competing, because they don't necessarily compete, but you find them trying to do the same thing in the same space, which makes the impact meaningless in terms of what we would want to achieve. So that's the first step that we are currently engaged in. The second one, which also has an impact on access, is financing. But not from a point of view of companies having finances, but insofar as what work government is doing, the amount of work. Currently, you find that which would be done by government compared to that which would be the same thing done by a private company, the prices for government will be 3, 4, 5, 10 times. And that limits the impact. The work that government then is able to dish out to these companies becomes limited, because the pricing when it comes to government is inflated. Now we need to deal with the source of the problem so that we are able to go far in terms of what we would want to see. Now we need to open that space. We need to regulate that space such that we have reasonable prices that are comparable both in private and public sector, so that the impact of what government can provide is extended, which is why your district development model, we would want to increase or expand our horizons and make a meaningful impact within communities. And if you are saying that we treat infrastructure as the catalyst to as a response to the high unemployment rate and as a response to job creation, we need to expand that horizon and deal with the source of the problem, and not deal with the So we are working with Treasury, with our entities, to to try and solve those problems. Because also, our supply chain management limits the ability of the entities to make a meaningful impact on transforming, especially in our sector. Because you will find one company is the one that gets this, because it is able to manipulate the prices in a manner that advantages it at the detriment of a number of small companies and a number of women-owned companies. So that also is the space which is where Treasury is really active now in trying to assist us, because the regulations as they are currently do not help us open the doors for women, do not help us open the doors for small companies. And therefore, we are working with Treasury to try and deal with that, even though they also point to the limitation in legislation. But we are engaging to say, if it is legislation, that legislation was written by human beings, it will take human beings to change it. So there is that engagement currently. So with respect to transformation of the sector, there are those bottlenecks that impede real fast transformation and entry or access into the sector. So we are working on those. On the issue of the cartel versus, I always say, for me, we tend to deal with issues as human beings in a funny way. We talk about cartel when it is big business, and we simply say pay without rubbishing their act to say actually it's corruption. That was corruption. And its implications, I don't think as a country now we have analyzed what that has done to the industry, price-wise and performance-wise. We it's something as the nation we must wake up to and deal with. Because it's my belief that if big companies, if at leadership people behave in a particular way, those that follow will also follow suit. And for me, this thing, when we say it's cartel, then we remove it from it being a corrupt practice. Okay, corrupt relationship between those companies. It limits our ability to deal with it when it happens at a lower level. Yet, the impact will be wide because you're dealing with many small companies, and which possibly is the reason why now we have so many challenges in the sector. It's something that all of us as leadership of the country, we must begin to work on. What was the impact of that corrupt relationship between those companies? And stop calling it a cartel. Because if we don't measure the impact of that and don't deal with it, we shall forever be complaining. I know that people it will be easy to say, no, they paid the 100 and what million. So what? So what? The monetary value cannot be compared with the impact of the ethical value. Or lack thereof, because for me that was lack of ethical values and performance. So it's something that we also need to deal with as a nation. But Chair, I do want to say we also need to relook the legislation. You see, the types of questions that members are coming up with on the regulating and the facilitating, and if you go to the Act, it's quite comprehensive. It expects a lot from this body, which requires, this is where that delineation of roles. There are some roles we need to take away from CIDP and give an appropriate organization. But if the legislation is not reviewed, that action is going to be difficult to deal with. That is why I'm then saying, as the bodies, we are interacting with a view to try and tease these issues that in the end lend the bodies, our entities, to be seen as bodies that underperform, because they are all over, and what should have been their focus becomes part of a whole host of other issues that they are dealing with. So for me, it requires both of us, ourselves and the Parliament, to work on both the legislation, but we must lead by teasing out those areas that require attention. But as you can see, the fact that there would be matters of emphasis. I always say, with organizations as small as ours, we don't need those. We don't need those. These are small organizations. They just must do their work in a diligent way and in an efficient way that is able to give us the kind of desired results, which is what is commonly known as a clean audit. We will be working, in fact, we are working together also in that space to try and push for proper oversight, as well as ensuring that we help drive the organizations to be effective in what they were set up for. Those, for me, would kind of sum up the kind of comments that from the honorable members came. But we need, if we are serious in saying infrastructure is the backbone of us developing the country, dealing with high unemployment and dealing with inequality, we must be seized with ensuring that the organizations that drive such transformation are placed in a manner or poised to do the kind of work they are expected to do. For me, transformation is a constitutional matter. It's something we can't run away from. It's the Constitution that talks about dealing with the injustices of the past. So, we can't run away from that constitutional prescript, but we must make it work. So thank you for your time, Honorable Chairperson and Honorable Members.
Thank you, Deputy Minister. Let me also take this opportunity to express the committee's appreciation in terms of the entity honoring our invite, but also more than that, an opportunity to put the committee in a much more better position to understand and appreciate the complexities within the environment in which you are operating,
particularly with regard to the challenges around the construction industry, but more so the transformation agenda, which is an imperative, like as the deputy has indicated. I think the committee is now in a much more better position now to engage with the entity in our future engagement. Like I said, Kate read at the beginning, to us this was also an induction in terms of the work that we are doing. Secondly, putting our concerns to rest with regards to key issues that were identified in the Auditor General's report. I think your audit action plan clearly illustrated the commitment on your part to address them. Your political head is a perfectionist. She won't expect any findings in the next audit report from where she comes from. So you must be ready. And this committee, I can assure you, we are also committed towards ensuring that at a provincial level, that's where our interest is. Our commitment to see the transformation, the regulatory framework, the compliance, to ensure that we use this platform to be able to empower our people to be in a position to equip themselves in terms of opportunities that are there. The transformation agenda needs drivers, needs commitment, and you can't be apologetic about it. You are in the far front of that battle line, so you must be ready. So therefore, without any waste of time, let me take this opportunity to express our gratitude. And until we meet again, thank you. The meeting is now adjourned.